All right, May 19th. Welcome to an episode of With CP. We got two awesome folks joining this call. Right off the bat, not wasting any time. Hey, Maria, are you there? Maria Bando, are you there? Not hearing you. Not hearing you, Maria.
But can
it's a
you
nice try. It was a good idea. There you are. Are you there?
Yes. And I think we've got Diane. And I wasn't able to hear you both when I was calling in with Diane on the phone and then getting into the app. So hopefully she'll see it and be able to get in.
Okay. So Diane Ware is going to join us today. And I see Charles has entered the live studio, but we're looking for Diane.
Hey!
Yeah, Charles is listening. Diane is an incredible community member. She's really been inspiring for all of us. So we know that this trickiness of getting into the app, getting into the podcast is the trick.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Oh, there she is. She said she's had the app since Iowa as well.
Okay.
Which is cool.
Okay, Diane, you're almost there. Just click on the chair. This is a With CP episode where we get a chance to interview one of our community members. And mm-hmm. The first threshold always is the technology.
Yeah.
Yay, Diane, here she comes.
Yes. All right, Diane.
Hi, Diane. We're so close. Diane, are you there? No.
Okay, now you can hear me.
Oh, yay.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Wow. This is a new level of tech savvy for me.
Thank you, Diane. Well, we appreciate it. And it's been a learning journey for everybody that's had to download this app and get in. And we appreciate it a lot. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's fun to be here.
All right. So, David, we're going to go ahead and get started. This is another Inside CP Community Highlight podcast episode. And we've got Diane Bayer on the line with us. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Can you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
I just celebrated my 77th birthday, so there are a lot of years Woo-hoo! There to cover. You know, I'm very a very organized thinker, so I'll start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Chicago, and I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. I'm Jewish and was raised in a very fairly traditional way. A lot of focus on a whole range of aspects of being Jewish. So it wasn't just religion; it was history and tradition and on and on, which had a big impact on my life. That really kind of was the sort of a benchmark in terms of just learning and thinking about the way in which we all are raised and the environment in which we grow up and how that impacts us and how we change over time. So it was a very important part of my life. And I did mm-hmm. have the wonderful experience, thanks to my dad, of going to Hebrew school for about 10 years. And most kids that I grew up with,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they dreaded it. They didn't want to go, but I went, and I mainly it was to learn, you know, Hebrew for prayers, but I also am very interested in language. So it was a great opportunity. And though I'm certainly not fluent in Hebrew, I can read Hebrew. And it would be very hard to start learning how to read Hebrew now. So I really value having that. And it's kind of helped a lot with learning, trying to learn other languages like Arabic, you know, because there's some similarities.
Do you know Arabic?
I wouldn't say I know it. I studied a little. Yeah, I have studied some Arabic, so I'm. I would like to do more. It's very interesting.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I'd love to learn Chinese, but I haven't gotten there yet. But I do love languages, and I love learning about people and different traditions, and so. I think as I've gotten older, I've been able to put my own tradition and way I grew up, et cetera, in that context as I've learned more about other cultures and other people. And one thing in particular that always sticks in my mind, because we were a big community, but it was like a minority community in the middle of a big city where the main community or the main culture was not my culture. it was sort of Christian. And so the idea, you know, some of the holidays or things that we didn't celebrate that the majority of people did celebrate, it was a very interesting experience. I went to public schools, and it was very interesting. Even in my public school, where sort of 90% of the people were Jewish, we had there was no evidence of any sort of Jewish celebrations. It was around Christmas time. We had, you know, big Christmas tree, and I learned all the Christmas carols, which I loved. I just do remember, though, that there were some words in the Christmas carols that felt like religious to me. And I do remember feeling like really uncomfortable singing those words. And sometimes I wouldn't. I would just, like in Silent Night, I would sort of mouth the parts that I didn't feel comfortable with. And back in those days, there was not really an outlet for talking about that. My parents would not be interested. They were just like, do what you're told, get good grades. That's the important thing. And certainly, you know, we weren't talking about that in classes or anything. So I think I have probably partially because of that developed a great deal of sensitivity to sort of the cultural context in which all different people live, and how the I forget what it's called, but when one group sort of appropriates the traditions of another group and uses it in a different way than the group to which it belongs use it, and how that how hurtful that is, and how it's just, you know, I think a lot of what I've done as I've, you know, gone on my journey, I've been very aware of that, and it's something that's important to me to be aware of and to work on raising awareness about and that sort of thing. So
Well, I wish more people had a little bit of that empathy and understanding, and that's a great foundation. And all still very, very relevant today, and probably always will be. But when did you end up in Seattle? Was all of that still in Chicago?
I lived in Chicago until I was 21. As I said, I went to public elementary school and high school. They didn't have middle school. So 8 years in elementary school, and then 4 years in high school. And then I went to a private university, but I lived at home, so I didn't live on campus. I commuted. And then I decided to go to graduate school in microbiology, and I ended up going to the University of Iowa. And even though Iowa is like, I mean, it's not very far from Chicago, Iowa City, as we know, we were just there. It's a pretty, you know, short drive. I had never been in the state of Iowa, which in retrospect is like a shocker to me. So that was quite a culture shift, and I just learned so much. I had always been interested in aspirationally in travel. My family didn't do that much traveling, but I would read books and I would dream about all these places I wanted to travel to. So I think that was like one of my first huge travel experiences, like going somewhere really different and learning about just a really different culture. In Iowa. It was very, it was the first place that I had ever met anyone, you know, who I was kind of connected to, like a classmate, who actually said to me, when he found out I was Jewish, he said, "Oh, you're the first Jewish person I've ever met." I had kind of heard that happened, but I didn't really believe it because I had never really experienced it. So that was an eye-opener and, you know, part of my education.
And but you were studying microbiology.
I was studying microbiology, which was super interesting. I really loved it.
We've had some cool conversations about that.
I was working with anaerobic organisms, which are interesting in themselves. I actually, when we just went back to Iowa for the caucuses with the Iowa group, I found out that the place that we lived when I was in Iowa City is now part of that big auditorium that we were in, that they had built it on the grounds where it used to be like post-World War II Quonset huts.
No way. Which auditorium do you remember?
I can't remember the name of it, but we went there for there was some event. Was it the comedian? Was he in that?
Oh, a podcast recording.
No, it was a concert of some sort. Or maybe it was, I just can't remember it was, but it was a huge event. It's a huge auditorium.
Maybe for Bernie Sanders.
Maybe that was it,
That's so cool.
Yeah, so I kind asked
full
someone,
circle.
Yeah, so that was interesting. And then the next few years was like my wandering years, journey, you know, traveling, living in a lot of different places in the United States, and ultimately ending up here in Seattle in 1970. Mm-hmm. And then in Seattle, I had gotten married when I lived in Iowa during school in Iowa. And by 1970, we had a little baby, my little daughter. Then she was 6 months old, and then that marriage did not survive, and I fortunately ended up in this place where my husband Jean-Lou ended up as well.
Yes.
And he came all the way from France, so it was I just came from Chicago, and we met here, and so the rest is a very happy history. And my daughter Sean's sister, Danielle, was born in 1977. And we have several grandchildren now. So, then the rest is, I've lived here ever since in Seattle. Mm-hmm. We had a year sabbatical in France, which was wonderful. But the rest of the time I've actually lived here, and we've done a lot of traveling. So that's been exciting.
Very cool.
Yeah. And I should mention that I got my PhD eventually in epidemiology. So ultimately that's working in. Yeah. So I did a lot of public health research, and so I'm really excited about what I can learn from about the virus now. That part of it is very interesting.
You're the first person to say
that. I know. That that's
there's
crazy.
Something about the virus that's exciting, but it's refreshing. It's good to hear. Well, I appreciate you sharing a little bit about yourself. I love asking that because as development manager within Common Purpose, I get the opportunity to hear from a lot of different people within our community about their backgrounds and where they come from. And there's so much breadth and depth of experience that I find interesting and that I hope that other people who might not be getting the chance to engage with our community very much right now, because obviously because of the virus and we're not having a lot of events, get a chance to hear a little bit about some of the really awesome people that we have in our community through these podcasts. So I appreciate that.
And it's absolutely true, Maria. They're awesome people in this community.
Yeah. I know, the best, the best. Yep. So how did you end up learning about Common Purpose and what have you done with us?
Well, you know, Jean-Lou and I participated in the Project Pilgrimage activities. Mm. We learned about that from a friend of ours who had participated in the civil rights pilgrimage to the South. And it sounded like something that we wanted to do. And then I had, I was sort of a David Domke groupie from 2000 and on. David just seemed to be the front edge, you know, the cutting edge of sort of analyzing and doing research on and presenting these amazing data about something that I had been very interested in, which is the rise of sort of religious language in politics and sort of in the whole area of separation of religion and government. So the first time I heard him speak, I was blown away. I thought, oh my God, there's this person who's actually studying this. And at that time, at our synagogue, we had a very, and we still do have a very active social justice action area. And one of the things we were very interested in was separation of religion and government. Mm. And so I remember, which I was not prone to do, I remember actually, can't remember if I did it or if my colleague did it, but just sort of pulled David out of a hat, like, where is this guy Burke? How do we get a hold of him? And either emailing him or calling him to ask him to speak at something. And every time he's kind of expanded or moved into something, that's a big plus. So certainly the Project Pilgrimage, and then as that moved into Common Purpose, that certainly was a part of our moving along with it. And then also just the having a more sort of powerful community presence and voice around civic engagement and voting. And, you know, the more I got involved, I've always felt very strongly about that, but I wasn't as aware of some of the roadblocks that were being put together to limit the access to voting for so many people in this country. And the more I learned about it, the more I guess it activated me even more. I mean, on something, it wasn't something new. It wasn't like, oh, I never cared about that, and now I do. Mm-hmm. But it was like, oh, this is a priority. This is not some minor thing. So, So I think that's what probably that's kind of a path that led us to Common Purpose. And And then I was very drawn by the, we both were, by the opportunity to work in other states. Because mm-hmm. one thing I had come to believe is that if you're in a safe, so-called safe state or locality and whatever you care about is all the policies are the way you want them to be, that doesn't mean you're not going to be impacted by what's happening in another state. In fact, you probably yeah. will. So I've grown more and more supportive of the idea of supporting activity in other places as well as my own. And mm-hmm. so that kind of fits with common purposes or is it still common purpose? Yeah. We just went to some kind of a meeting the other day, but CP.
Good. So,
That's
cool. That's kind of a little bit like my journey too. I mean, I didn't know about David's previous work and the lectures that he did before. And some people say, legend has it that David wasn't always in shorts back then either. So I didn't know David pre-shorts, David.
I don't want to, you know, I mean, it might make him feel bad if I admit that I didn't even notice. So oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, as I got to know David and get to know CP a little bit too, I think I had known definitely that there was voter suppression. And I'd heard about gerrymandering definitely within my own personal communities. I unfortunately heard people say, you know, they don't want us to vote. It doesn't matter if we vote. There isn't a whole lot that we actually have the power to be able to do, to fix things. It's all a scam because of the ways that systematically people have been left out of the process, or that there have been systematic barriers enacted to keep people from participating. So I definitely knew, but it wasn't until taking that real deep dive, doing some learning on my own, and getting to hear some of David's lectures and stuff that I kind of filled in some of the pieces I didn't know before and kind of connected the dots a little bit and realized this is how we got here. And this is the avenue in which we could change things as well, and that I could actually be a part of changing things. So it's cool how powerful just a little bit more education can be when trying to figure out, okay, here's a problem. We need to solve it, but how did we get there? You know, what were the things that led up to where we are now with Trump and all of that? So I definitely agree that the lectures are a great way to do that. And then I jumped in and,
Here I am.
And you mentioned that you went to Iowa with us for the Iowa caucuses as part of our CP civic tours that we did at the start of the year, which we're lucky to get off before coronavirus.
Were we ever? Yes.
Yeah. But have you done anything else with CP since then? You and Jean-Lou are incredible supporters for us, and I know you've been engaged with the Iowa team, but can you talk a little bit about any experiences you've had?
With CP or in general?
Yeah, you know, maybe it sounds like you got to CP through kind of your passion and interests in language and culture and religion, and that's how you got to David, and then that's kind of how you got to CP. But did you have a lot of grounding before in understanding voter suppression specifically? Were you politically engaged a lot before this? Were there any other issues that you were engaging around before voting justice?
Oh yeah, definitely. In fact, voting justice as sort of the primary issue, kind of the driving issue, that how it affects everything else. To recognize that more, I'd say more recently, that I didn't totally appreciate the importance for everything else that I care about. You know, if policies cannot be developed, reflect a change or a direction that I support in terms of a society where there's more compassion and more equity and fairness for all people, justice for all. If that kind of society cannot result from our, you know, our governmental structure, our democracy, if we don't really have a democracy, then all the things I care about aren't going to turn out the way I want them to turn out. So I've arrived at realizing how important the issues that are blocks to fair voting for all, I've arrived to realize how important that is. Prior to that, I was more focused on what I would call human and civil rights type issues. In particular, in the last maybe, I guess, 10, 20 years, I've been very, very, I've worked most, I guess, on issues that are related to sort of developing the kind of relationships across lines of religion and race, and and finding sort of common ground in that process so that we can work together to ensure that all people are the recipients of the kind of benefits that we want to see, that poverty is addressed, and that racial and religious and ethnic intolerance is addressed. Those are the things that have really driven me. And so where I've spent a lot of time over the last, I'd say, I kind of retired in 2000 from my professional work in epidemiology, and I had more time. I wanted to have more time to do more work for myself as well, in stepping into the spaces that I wasn't familiar with, that I cared about, but I wasn't. I hadn't really spent time with the Muslim community, for example, or spent time learning more about Christianity, or sort of the different values that we have that drive us, and so I spent a lot of time in those spaces, building relationships and getting to know members of different communities, and then in my own community, sort of leading those efforts as well, so that now when we have concerns about voting, for example, it's very exciting to me to know that there are in the broader community focusing on that priority, there are people from all these different, kind of ethnic communities and religious communities. We're all working together. It's a common it's a common theme. And 20 years ago it wasn't. I don't know that we talked at all. Like if I met with another faith community, for example, I'm not sure that voting was the main topic. It might be more like poverty or intolerance, you know. So I guess that, you know, that's kind of a roundabout way of painting my journey. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, wow. Proximity is so important, and right. being willing to step outside of what you know and outside of your bubble and your comfort zone to be able to be in proximity with people that are different from you. I think there's nothing that can kind of shake your biases and help you understand people that are different from you more than proximity does. It's an amazing yeah. thing, just being close to people, and something that I hope that I can work on a little bit more too. So I think it's cool that you made so much space and held so much intentionality for being able to do that. But so you didn't do any like engaging with politics before, any type of like door knocking or phone banking or anything like that?
No, of course I've done that.
Oh, okay.
I guess what I just mentioned was more the forest. You know, it was like I have been kind of intentional. I don't know that I sat down and wrote out a plan, but in my sort of personal vision, in a way. In fact, in Judaism, I don't know, you know, there's the Torah is like the, you know, mm-hmm. the basic book of the, whatever they call it, of the religion, like the Quran and Islam, or I guess maybe mm-hmm. the Gospels and in Christianity. But there's this idea that each person can sort of write their own Torah, you know, so that resonates for me. It's like every, there's like new chapters every few years. And I guess if I were to think of the overarching title of the chapter for the last 20 years or 25 years, it was what I just said, that, you know, getting really stepping into these spaces. But in that process, I worked on political campaigns. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call myself a partisan, although I don't know that I've ever voted for a Republican. I think once I did. But, so I would probably look like a partisan from my voting record, but I wouldn't call myself a partisan. You know, it's not like... like I look at the party first. I place a lot of value on the individual candidates and what they're running for and what their main issues are. More of an mm-hmm. issue person. But in that context, I've worked on a number of campaigns, and I've done door knocking, and I've done calling, phone banking and text banking, and like data related work. And I worked very, very hard in the early 90s on the reproductive rights initiative. I don't know. I don't know. You probably weren't born, but I don't know if you were born yet. But it was
year was that?
I think it was 91 or 92.
Not quite.
So it was the goal was to put the Roe v. Wade protections into our state law. Because up until then, there were, someone had to get like permission from their husband or something to have an abortion. I mean, it was pretty, pretty bizarre.
All right.
And so I did work very, very hard on that. And that was probably one of my first experiences, like, you know, this not quite as bad as this Trump disaster, but where we had a really great record in this state at supporting reproductive rights. I mean, there had been a mm-hmm. number of other measures that had consistently been defeated to try to make inroads into cutting away at those rights, especially for vulnerable communities, people on you know, on public support or that sort of thing. So there was a great deal of, I think, what would I say, confidence that this would, there would be no problem. This would pass. It was a an initiative that went to the, or maybe it was a referendum, and ultimately it did get voted on by the people. And I just remember being at that party, looking at the votes coming in and realizing this thing might not pass. You know, this is like, and what happened? And that's a little bit of the same feeling I had when Trump was elected, except, well, no, except, I mean, so I think that kind of introduced me to the, a little more to the real world of politics and, you know, democracy and influence and, you know, how hard you have to work. If you really, if there's an issue and you really care about it, you can't just do like, oh, I'm going to knock on doors for 3 days and then I've done my part and that's, it's done. Because you really have to keep pushing away or else.
Yes.
It's like, I mean, it's like if there's no strong force pushing back, then the side that you don't want to get through will not have any opposition and just come right flying right through. So that was a terrific learning lesson, and I you know I've done a lot of work in recent years on immigrant justice and refugee justice. And also, I never know what to call the area, but it's kind of, I kind of alluded to it before, like building interfaith relations, interfaith, interethnic, interracial relations for the common good. So working against against intolerance, you know, trying to find those issues where the effect of a particular position will benefit a whole group of people, like the Muslims and the Jews and the Mormons. And, you know, and that's been probably my most, or the sort of the proudest times when there have been some legislation that, when passed, it had an impact on a number of different minority communities.
Yeah.
And when that, to be able to speak to our state legislators and to show up as like, you know, a Black person, a Muslim, a Jew, you know, all speaking for the same thing when they have their stereotypes about who's working with whom, that really makes me very happy, and I'd like to see more of that. And I see Common Purpose CP as promoting that as well. So that's something that draws me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, the humanities professional type of person in me is like getting really excited hearing you talk about all of that. And then also, of course, yes, CP is going to be in this for the long run. We're going to be fighting as long as there is a fight to be had around voting justice. And we're really glad to have you, Diane, and all of our volunteers and supporters along in that fight with us. But I will say, it does kind of hurt a little bit thinking about you in the early 90s, before I was even born, fighting for women's reproductive rights then, and that we're still having that fight today. And if I could just geek out a little bit about Iowa, since we've talked about Iowa a little bit. And for those of you who don't know, I am one of the state leads for our CP Iowa team that would have traveled in April, but didn't get the chance. alongside my co-lead, Mary Fiegel. And since I've been following Iowa, since I've been the state lead, I've learned a little bit about how they make their state laws and that some things need to be changed via constitutional amendment, which only happens every so often. And 2020 happens to be a year when there's some pretty big constitutional amendments on the line in Iowa. And one of them, I'll mention briefly, is about making sure that folks who have been previously been convicted of felonies have the right to vote again, because Iowa is one of those states with that cruel law where folks are completely disenfranchised after they have been convicted of a felony. But the other constitutional amendment that is on the line here in 2020 is about the right to abortion. There is no law in Iowa that gives women the right to get an abortion. And there's a constitutional amendment. I know that when the state legislature gets back into session, I think they're paused right now because of coronavirus, but they're going to be talking about that and seeing if it's going to be put on the ballot in the next few years for voters to vote on. But there's all this controversy around it because basically the state Supreme Court in, I believe, 2018 or 2019 had said that women do have a right to an abortion. And then I believe, unfortunately, that the justice who had made those comments passed away. Mm-hmm. And now his seat has to be filled this year, as well as four other seats in Iowa. So there's five state Supreme Court seats that are going to be filled in 2020. And this abortion issue is a big deal when it comes to that and when it comes to these constitutional amendments. So it's exciting. It's exciting how much we have going on in Iowa. So a little bit of a plug for Team Iowa.
Yeah.
Folks, if you want to get involved, go to our website and sign up to get updates from me about Iowa in case we get to travel. But also, yeah, it sucks that we're still here, which to me, I apologize because folks out there might have some different views on this, but I won't apologize for mine, which is that I do believe that women should have the right to make a choice over their own bodies and that we're still fighting for this even now. It's just, it just goes to show that you're absolutely right. We have to keep pushing. There's no way that we can just kind of give up on some of these things. We have to be in it for the long run, for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's why I really appreciate, that concept that's come out of CP, that democracy is a verb. Because what I can reflect a bit on going from the 1970s to the 1990s or 2000 with regards to women's rights and reproductive rights or reproductive choice and some of those issues that were so hard fought in the 60s and 70s, because I remember that. I remember what it was like before that. I remember during, I remember after. And as with any, I think most movements, sometimes there can be, like a little bit of it's gone in the right place, but then there could be a little bit of, spillover to maybe going, I won't say too far, but going farther. And then the people on the other end are just looking at that and feeling like, discounted or so sometimes there are, like with the women's movement, I think there was a lot of change and yeah. Absolutely, I certainly feel it was going in a good direction, but yeah. I think at the same time, there were people who were understanding it a certain way. And, we often forget to stop and talk to each other. Like, well, this is what we're feeling, and this is why we're saying this. And, you know, someone at the other end saying, well, you know, this is what I'm feeling. I'm feeling threatened, or, I'm, you know, whatever. We don't do that, I don't think. We want to. We want to find a way of doing that. But it's so, it's very challenging. And so I think we end up with, you know, someone like Trump getting elected for president. And I still have a hard time. I guess the only conclusion I've come to is that, except for probably some portion of people who really believe in him, that some people voted for him because they didn't take their vote very seriously. They didn't see it as a critical choice and decision. And that's what I think CP's work on civic engagement, that's part of what I'm hoping we can change, that the vote and the, the privilege and the right to vote is really so precious. And I don't know that that's really, I don't know the kids in school, if that's what they're being taught. Are they being taught, you know, how much civics are they being taught? I don't know. I mean, I have my little grandkids, so I ask them all the time, you know, what they're learning. And I certainly talk about voting a lot. So, I think there's a tendency to take things for granted when they are apparently finalized, like something like reproductive rights or the voting, you know, like the Voting Act, the 1960s, you know, Voting Act.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whoever, I mean, I remember when John Lewis started to talk fairly recently, in the last 10 years or so, that there was some fear that it would be modified. And I didn't take it seriously. I didn't think, oh, no, I would never do that. And so, as I'm getting older, I'm thinking maybe there are never any settled issues. Maybe, you know, we have to constantly, it's like your house or something, you know. You do have to kind of, fill in the cracks and check it out every few years to make sure that there aren't any cracks. And if there are, you have to fix them right away or else it'll fall down, you know.
Yeah. And I'm just getting to learn even more about that stuff and the Voting Rights Act through Carol Anderson's One Person, No Vote, which we've been reading in CP and is actually our first CP book club book. We're having book club this Thursday at 5:00 to talk a little bit more about that. But oh my gosh, I was just appalled, interested and appalled to just read about it and hear about the players that have been in it for a long time now around voting rights, including like Jeff Sessions and John Roberts, folks like that. Right. So the more that I learn, the more just like fired up I get, you know. And I hope that people, especially now after having Trump for a term, will take their vote seriously. And I think there's a lot of people that do. But there is one thing I wanted to ask you about, and you did mention it before, and I think it's just an inspiring piece of your story and something that Trump has definitely had a big impact on, which is immigrants' rights. It has been a huge, hugely divisive issue, especially now within Trump's presidency. But I know it's an issue that you have been engaging a lot around, especially with your husband, Jean-Lou, being somebody who's from France. And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about what you've been up to.
Oh, I'd be glad to. Well, Jean, we are kind of a family of immigrants. We Jean-Lou is from France. My son-in-law is from Morocco. My cousin is from Malaysia. My, you know, I could go on and on. I'm a first generation American. My father was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. And we experienced in my own family the impact of the 1924 national quota or national, or it was a National Country of Origins Act, something like that, because Eastern European, especially, which was predominantly Jews, there was a quota on visas that were given, and down to practically nothing. I mean, it was a huge change. So many members of my own family were not able to immigrate after that time. My own father and grandmother just made it. You know, I don't know why they procrastinated or whatever. They didn't, you know, people didn't want to leave their homes. They were facing a lot of violence, and they had to. I mean, so all of those factors are part of why I care deeply. I believe, you know, the things I grew up with about America, the beautiful, it's still a part of me. I'm not cynical, you know. I believe in this country and the dream of this country. And even though the more I learn, it seems a little, there are hypocritical things along the way written, you know, that were happening while we were saying America for all, while we're, you know, not really including all. But I think the aspiration is beautiful, and I want to see that happen. And so it's just, it's unconscionable to me that people who live in this country, who have come here to make a better life as, you know, migrants, migration is part of the human phenomenon. You know, the migration has occurred forever. So right. I find it, I just can't find a way of understanding a response that is sort of similar to what's going on with the Trump administration and to some extent with the Obama administration, where deportation was enhanced. In Obama's administration, supposedly they focused on people with criminal records. But really, when you look at what they did, they tried to get into the United States two or three times instead of once. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't rob anybody. So I find the criteria that are being used to target people who have immigrated from other countries, the criteria are cruel and honestly don't seem to be very well thought out. Basically, the immigration system is broken. And we know that there are about 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States right now. And they all have different stories. You know, when you have someone that maybe came on a visa and then the visa expired, and then the only way that you could renew the visa was by leaving the country for 10 years. And you already had a family with American-born children. And there's so many different stories. And I think there are ways of addressing those stories, those situations that are humane and that take into account the good of society. Yes, you don't break laws. You don't break criminal laws. Yes, you work, you earn a living, you pay taxes. Those things are happening. You know, people, immigrants who are even undocumented, are paying taxes. But they are being, they're also being targeted for being, you know, picked up by the immigration enforcement in larger yeah. numbers, putting by being detained in a facility that is called a detention center, but it's really a prison. Mm-hmm. It's privately owned. I mean, there are just a lot of factors that are, I believe, inhumane. And our, we can do better, put it that way.
Yes. Yes.
And so what I've been doing is through a number of organizations in different ways. I guess the main thing that I've been working on is a learning more about the immigration system. Understanding better, you know, what the sort of the laws are, where the problems come in, why people who are being picked up by the enforcement arm of the immigration, why are they being picked up? You know, what did they do? That sort of thing. And then there are different organizations that are focusing more on laws that help to develop policies that make it sort of have our state operating in a way that is more appropriate. So laws that, for example, don't allow a local sheriff from holding someone who he thinks immigration would be interested in jail for no reason, and calling immigration and saying, we've got this person, we'll hold them for you, and then immigration come and arrest a person and take them to detention. That was very common until our state passed a law 2 years ago to prohibit that. Another situation is people would go to regular court, you know, because they had a driving ticket or they were asked to be a witness in a, you know, for some reason, sort of the criminal justice area of things. Mm-hmm. Or I'm not sure if, like to go get a marriage license or another mm-hmm. kind of, maybe another sort of document that it's necessary to go to court, like the county court.
Sure.
Or the. And what was happening was that there was some collaboration between some people in the court and immigration enforcement. And so the Immigration and Customs Enforcement is also called ICE. And someone from ICE would show up in plain clothes, no uniform, with a car without mark, you know, not marked. And a person would come to court, go into court, maybe complete their, you know, their hearing or whatever, be on their way out. And ICE would kind of, in one case, literally jump this guy, push him down.
Jeez.
And I think sometimes they may call someone's name, you know, they might say, Jose, you know, and maybe someone might turn around. And they took that, I guess, as proof that this was someone who needed to be arrested. They didn't have a warrant, the proper kind of warrant. They would handcuff them, put them in the car, and take them to detention. And their families, in some cases, the families had no idea what happened. I mean, there was this one story of this woman whose husband went to take care of some business at the court, and he didn't come home. And she had no idea what happened to him. So there's a great organization that's developed since Trump was elected. This activity has been enhanced since Trump was elected because the Trump administration has adopted a broader policy than, you know, I think in the Obama administration, they were trying to deal with what they saw as criminals, that were undocumented immigrants and deal with them. And Trump has taken that and has added on, you know, all kinds of other policies, so that now the fact that someone could be detained where a person has no right to a lawyer, I don't know if people know this, they have no right to a call to their family to let them know where they are. And they have no right, it's expected that they will find out why they're there, but it could take, I just looked at the data the other day, there are 400 people in the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma that have been put in there, arrested, and they're waiting for their hearings, their initial hearing, to sort of be told, you know, like why they're there, and if they're going to be deported, or if they, you know, if there's some way that they can have a stay put on their deportation order, they're in there waiting, and it could be, you know, days, weeks, months that they're there. Jeez, and hopefully eventually their families will find out. So this kind of situation, I mean, that's one area that I've been working on, different, you know, the educational component, like informing community members about that, some advocacy and direct action work. The Washington Immigrant Solidarity Network has developed since 2016. It's a great organization of over 200, a coalition of over 200 organizations working on, I mentioned legislation is one thing. Another thing is deportation defense. So things like rapid response, where community members are trained to respond if there seems to be a situation where ICE is showing up and sort of searching around for people, like there's a group near our Home Depot. There are often people, probably not now, but when the virus isn't around, people that are waiting for jobs that can be sort of find jobs there. Someone can go there and talk to someone. And it was found that that was kind of dangerous because ICE would show up and they sometimes just round people up. It's like fishing, It's like we round up all these 10 people, maybe there are 8 of them that we can keep. And there is actually, there is. I mean, the detention center is privately owned. The federal government is budgeted for a certain number of detention beds per day, per year.
And being privately owned means that whoever owns it makes a profit off of this, right?
They make a profit, and we pay taxes that are appropriated to the Department of Homeland Security. Our Congress approves the appropriation of a certain amount of money to the Department of Homeland Security that is part of the ICE budget to make sure that there are something like 34,000 beds paid for every night. Mm. And in our detention center in Tacoma, I believe the minimum is 800. So that means that they get paid for 800 beds a night if they're filled or not. And so on the part of the government, I'm sure in this administration, there's an incentive to fill them.
Certainly.
So it's really just a difficult situation. And, we try to establish a network of accompaniment volunteers. These are community members that will accompany someone who's going to, have a biometric appointment after applying for maybe a visa or a work permit. There's a biometric requirement, fingerprints, background check. And people, you know, immigrants are afraid to go by themselves. So sometimes they'll request, is there someone that can come with me, walk with me? And not fill out the paperwork, but just be there, you know? Yeah. And and then I mentioned the deportation defense is a whole series of ways of kind of protecting people from being inappropriately arrested. There's supposed to be a certain kind of warrant that ICE has in order to be able to arrest someone for an immigration offense. And they often do not have the right warrant. They use another one, and they use a lot of intimidating language. So it's just kind of learning about all of that and how to deal with it and how to be community allies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate you sharing about all of that, because our system around immigration definitely is broken and definitely is an issue that is going to be impacted by this coming election and whoever gets elected into our administration next. And hopefully we'll be able to make some change around that and around the women's rights issues that we were talking about. Overall, it's been a great conversation, Diane. I've really appreciated what you've shared with us.
Well, it's been fun.
Oh, thank you. I think I had heard, was that your phone in the background there?
Yeah, I moved.
Okay.
That phone's not supposed to ring.
No problem. Well, I just wanted to be cognizant of your time as well. And I just want to say thank you, Diane. You and Jean-Luc both have been incredible supporters of ours. It's been so fun getting to travel with you, getting to hear from you, and get to know you and your perspective better. And I take all of these things that you say to heart about our humanity and making sure that we understand that, you know, we need to step outside of our bubble and our comfort zone and really talk to other people and just get to know them. So I hope that that's something we've been able to do a little bit today. And I hope that's something I'm going to be able to do a lot more after this. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And we're very, of course, supportive of CP, and we look forward to doing a lot more, you know, keep on doing more of what we've been doing. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been another one of our With CP Community Spotlight episodes, and hopefully if you listen to this and you got a little bit inspired maybe about Iowa, you can go to cpnow.org and go to fieldwork to be able to sign up and get some updates on Iowa. And hopefully we'll be able to travel soon. And Diane is on our Iowa team. So if there is that chance, or if there's that chance for us to be able to do some phone banking or do something, we might be able to do that together. And also, just want to mention one more time that Common Purpose is having Carol Anderson's One Person, No Vote as our first book club book. And we'll be having our first book club discussion this Thursday at 5:00, if you're interested in joining that. But otherwise, Diane, hopefully I get to talk to you soon. And
well,
thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks, Diane.
Yeah.
You too.
Bye-bye.